Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
The ICRC has been known to Israeli and to the Hamas for many years now, and we have contacts, direct contact with the warring parties.
The International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC, plans to continue helping to transfer hostages to Israel and Palestinian detainees to reunite with their families.
The list of political offenders that the court during the election was compiled, but I have been actually surprised that up to now that action has not been taken on that issue. Thankfully, the files have been given to NBA, and NBA will soon issue letters of instructions to the different lawyers in the different zones who have been choosing to prosecute this matter on behalf of INEC.
The Electoral Commission of Nigeria plans to begin the prosecution of electoral offenders during the recent general election.
We now have Somalia joining a regional economic bloc, which can also, you know, develop into a regional security bloc. So we have a regional security framework. I think that's good.
And the East African Community admits Somalia as the 8th member of the regional bloc. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC, plans to continue helping transfer hostages to Israel to be reunited with their families. It will also help hand over Palestinian detainees to authorities in the West Bank so they can return to their families. In addition, the ICRC will bring in additional medical supplies for hospitals in Gaza. It comes as both Israel and Hamas have agreed to the exchange. The news media reports that another group of hostages will be released today. The International Humanitarian Organization is also calling for hostages and detainees to be treated with humanity, and humanitarian principles must be respected at all times, including during the releases and transfers. For more details about the role of the ICRC following the agreement between Israel and Hamas, I read Leticia Kotoa via Zoom. She is the permanent observer to the United Nations and head of the delegation of the International Committee of the Red Cross in New York.
It is important to mention that the ICRC has been known to Israeli and to the Hamas for many years now, and we have contacts, direct contact with the warring parties for years, and have facilitated similar operations in the past. Now, this time, obviously, the role of the ICRC is not to negotiate such agreements, but once those agreements between the warring parties are made and are reached, our work is to make sure that they can happen concretely and realistically in the best way. So we need to make sure that the least of people to be released is exchanged and agreed upon, that the safety of the route that are being identified is ensured, that the timing is also working perfectly. And those operations are also based on our experience in such a release and exchange of detainees that we have had in the region and throughout the world. So our work has been quite important in that particular phase of the implementation of the agreement.
Will this role be replicated in future agreements, especially with this ongoing conflict?
Well, as you mentioned, it is a multi-days operation. So we want to see the success of today being repeated tomorrow and as many days as it will take to get all the hostages being released. So we really hope that today's success is helping building the trust between the parties to continue further with those type of operations and until every single hostage is released.
Now, the ICRC called on both sides to ensure all hostages and detainees are treated with humanity, and humanitarian principles must be respected at all times, including during the releases and transfers as the process carries on. How do you ensure that this is done by both parties?
This is a very important point indeed. We've been saying from the onset that the hostages need to be released immediately and conditionally, And at the same time, while they are being kept, to be treated in the best possible ways, which mean having access to medical treatment when they need it, having contact with their families, being allowed to receive a humanitarian visit from the ICRC. Now, for the detainees in Israeli prisons, this is also something that is particularly at our heart. We visit regularly jails in Israel that detain Palestinian people, and we make sure that similar conditions are also struck, and make sure that those people also will be provided the best treatment during their detention throughout.
All right. So, Leticia, what's the situation in Gaza at the moment, and what role is the ICRC playing there?
Well, the situation is tragic. Unfortunately, it's been described in very worrisome terms. The number of people that have been impacted, civilians in particular, is beyond imagination. And the destruction as well of basic services such as water, infrastructure, but also the provision of electricity, power that can also maintain all the structures and those services has been very, very strongly impacted. So the urgent needs right now remain to, first of all, ensure safety for the people, make sure that they can be protected wherever they are. All civilians are entitled to this protection under international humanitarian law, that the provision of services are immediately resumed or taken care of by provision of humanitarian assistance from outside into Gaza Strip, and that people have a capacity to be treated in the facilities, hospitals, but also being hosted whenever they have to flee their houses with adequate housing and material to cope for their basic needs.
As a neutral intermediary, what is the message from the ICRC to both parties regarding this ongoing conflict?
Our message has been very clear. This conflict, this war, needs to respect a minimum of humanity, respect the principles that are enshrined in the Geneva Conventions and the rules of war applicable right now. This will save lives of people. This will preserve the infrastructure that people rely on, and this will reinject an important, immediate, much needed dose of humanity that we are currently lacking.
Leticia Kotwa is the permanent observer to the United Nations and head of the delegation of the International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC. She spoke with me via Zoom from New York. On the first day of a truce and a hostage and prisoner swap Friday between Israel and Hamas, aid, supplies and fuel slowly began entering the Gaza Strip from Egypt's Rafah border crossing. Arab media reported that more than 100 aid trucks entered Gaza by mid-afternoon. For VOA, Edward Uranian reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
More than 100 fuel and aid trucks entered Gaza Friday as a hostage and prisoner swap between Israel and Hamas was being implemented. Egyptian officials stated that 4 trucks of cooking gas and 130,000 liters of diesel fuel will be allowed into Gaza each day of the planned 4-day truce, alongside food and medical supplies. 13 Israelis held hostage by Hamas were handed over to Egypt by Hamas via the Rafah border crossing as dusk approached. Qatar's Al Jazeera TV also reported that the Palestinian Qassam group released 24 hostages, including workers from Thailand. Israel released 39 Palestinian prisoners from Israel's Damoun, Megiddo, and Al-Far detention centers earlier Friday afternoon. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who was hosting the Spanish and Belgian prime ministers on Friday, said in a televised address that international leaders, including U.S. President Joe Biden, have told him that Palestinians will not be forced out of Gaza and into Egypt. He says that, practically speaking, living conditions in Gaza are impossible, and this will push people to leave the area. He says he spoke with U.S. President Joe Biden, who assured him that he would not permit the forced migration of Palestinians out of Gaza and into Egypt. Sisi adds that both the visiting Spanish and Belgian prime ministers concurred with Egypt, saying they will not tolerate any forced migration of Palestinians. Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez told journalists during a visit to Egypt's Rafah border crossing Friday that the European Union is hoping to get more aid into Gaza than is currently entering the Strip. Sanchez called for Hamas to release all remaining hostages and urged Israel to show more restraint.
I also reiterate Israel's right to defend itself, but it must do so within the parameters and limitations imposed by international humanitarian law. And this is not the case. The indiscriminate killing of innocent civilians, including thousands of boys and girls, are completely unacceptable. Violence will only lead to more violence.
Sanchez went on to propose an international peace conference to discuss the ongoing Arab-Israeli conflict and to stress the need to implement a two-state solution between Israel and Palestinians. Visiting Belgian Prime Minister Alexander De Croo stated that the goal of the European Union's mediation between Israel and the Palestinians was a permanent ceasefire and to allow the entry of the massive backup of humanitarian aid supplies on the Egyptian side of the border. He also criticized Israel's military operation in Gaza while condemning the Palestinian Hamas group, which runs Gaza.
On the other side of this border, horrific fighting has taken place. Too many civilians have been killed. They were the first victims, and as always, the first victims are in general women and children. Families have been torn apart. Communities have been destroyed. Israel has the right to defend its citizens. The horror of Hamas is barbaric, and Hamas needs to do everything to release all the innocent hostages. Probably today 13 hostages will be liberated, but 13 hostages is not enough. All the civilian hostages that have been captured need to return home. Please send them home now.
Arab and Islamic leaders called for an unconditional ceasefire and efforts by the international community to implement a two-state solution between Israel and the Palestinians during a joint Arab-Islamic summit in the Saudi capital Riyadh on November 11. Edward Uranian, VOA News, Cairo.
Today, November 25th, marks the beginning of the 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence. It is an annual campaign that runs through International Human Rights Day on December 10th. Led by civil society, the campaign is supported by the United Nations through the Secretary General's Unite by 2030 to End Violence Against Women initiative. This year, the UN marks the 16 days under the theme Unite, Activism to End Violence Against Women and Girls. For more on the significance of this campaign, my colleague Douglas Mpuga reached Lema Gbowee. She is a 2011 Nobel Peace Prize recipient from Liberia.
Well, for me as a feminist, as an activist, this is a very important period for all of the work that women have been doing, but for all of the issues of gender-based violence, whether in quote-unquote peacetime or during conflict. I think it's very important now for us, now more than ever before, for us to raise our voices and to raise the issue of gender-based violence.
Do you think, in your opinion, this issue of gender-based violence is taken seriously in most parts of Africa?
Well, one of the things that I've come to realize is that when it is expedient politically, then people put it up there. So, for example, in many spaces in Africa, when it's election time, when they want the women's vote and people talk about it, or when they're going to major conferences where donors' funding is tied to some of these issues, then people talk about it. So it is a political, if I may say, a political decoration for many governments. But for the women who are impacted by these crises all over, it is life insurance. It is what they live for. So on our continent, you see more and more women are advocating in raising the issue. They are not stopping, even where there are no funds to do this work. It's like a daily thing, because that's the only thing they can do to safeguard themselves and the girls that will come after them. So it's still a huge issue for us as women on the continent. And we're hopeful, I'm hopeful that one day it would not just be the political game, but the politics would be action will follow some of the political talk.
See, as you mentioned, violence against women and girls remains the most pervasive human rights violation around the world, in fact, not only in Africa. What more ought to be done to make this issue be handled properly?
Well, you see, right now, when you look at from the level of the UN, AU, ECOWAS, in my case, they have all of these policy papers that talk about violence against women being horrible. I think what is important right now is for us to take all of those policy documents and turn them into actionable agenda, followed by funding and followed by measures that are no longer about impunity. So we need to take it from the paper. It's very good for us to continue to celebrate 16 days of activism, but I dream of the days when 16 days will be 16 days of chatting some of the gains that we've made instead of consistently talking about the challenges that we continue to face. Basically, the only thing I will add is that, like everyone has said before, over and again, women's rights are human rights, but it's very important to note that for any community, any society, any nation to do well, the women must be doing well. And I think 16 days is not enough. 365 days, women's rights issue should be at the front of every national agenda.
Lema Agbowi is a 2011 Nobel Peace Prize recipient from Liberia. She spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpoga from the Guinean capital, Accra. In Nigeria, the Independent National Electoral Commission, or INEC, has announced plans to begin the prosecution of electoral offenders apprehended during the recent general election. The electoral body says it is teaming up with the Nigerian Bar Association, or NBA, to prosecute the offenders. The selected lawyers from all the 35 states will work pro bono or for free following a meeting between leaders of the NBA and INEC. Lawyer John Ekpopo Martins is the chairman of the NBA Spidol section. He tells me that the prosecution of electoral offenders will serve as a deterrent and also discourage wrongdoing in elections in Nigeria.
I'm aware that the list of electoral offenders that were caught during the elections was compiled. But I have been actually surprised that up to now that action has not been taken on that issue. So thankfully, the files have been given to NBA, and NBA will soon issue letters of instructions to the different lawyers in the different zones who have been chosen to prosecute this matter on behalf of Ireland.
Does the NBA's involvement, the Law Association's involvement, part of the plan to sanitize the electoral system to enable Nigerians have confidence in the electoral processes in Nigeria?
Exactly. I will refer back to, I think it was 2011. I was a member of the NBA election working group at that time on behalf of NBA that went to see the then chairman of INEC, that is Professor Jega. Our proposition to him that time was that electoral offenses must be punished. Reason be that where there are no consequences, you cannot expect a change. So if during the election period, citizens are allowed to get involved in all kind of misbehavior, criminal actions, and there are no consequences, what do you expect? So the NBA has been at the forefront. It's like an opportunity to show that we don't have to spend money because we are lawyers. So our services can be rendered pro bono without any break of sweat. So that is a way, like you said, just the question you asked, yes, it is an indication that the NBA is very, very much interested in sanitizing the electoral process in Nigeria.
The electoral offenses, the report suggests, range from culpable homicide, unlawful possession of firearms, snatching and destroying of INEC items, and misconduct at polling units, among other charges. Are these a true reflection of what happened?
Naturally, you see, during elections, if you don't live in Nigeria, there are electoral offenses can come in various forms, and the offenders can be even as high as political office holders. Even sometimes, even the soldiers or let me say members of the law enforcement agency may also be involved. This is just the way it is. So, the offenses that are likely going to be tried, I'm very sure that INEC may have compiled the cases as investigated by the police. I am very sure we are going to see cases of homicide, cases of ballot snatching, cases of disruption of voting, and many other malfeasance that you can think of. But they are all encompassed in the electoral offenses if they happen during the election, on election day, at polling units, or at the coalition units.
Mr. Martin, what do you say to those who are of the opinion that perhaps those who support or fund some of these alleged crimes should not be let off the hook? They say some of these politicians purposely fund some of these so-called thugs. Your thoughts?
I will not agree generally that the reasons why some of these politicians unleash their voice on the political system is because they might not win the election. No, that is not correct. I have been observing elections in Nigeria for so many years now. We have many elections. You'll be shocked to know that politicians, they are usually more violent in areas where they have a majority of support because they are usually afraid of going to unleash mayhem in areas where they don't have much support, but they may be overwhelmed by the opposing forces. So you find out in the example that if politician A is very, very influential or has a lot of support in constituency A, it is that constituency A he will concentrate his forces on to undermine the process. So in a situation where, or if there have been a fair and fair election, he may have won maybe a majority of votes, maybe by only 15%, but when he overwhelms the other, he may win by 80%. So it is not necessarily true that those who foment these troubles or who unleash this electoral violence trying to corrupt the electoral process are those who are afraid of losing. No.
Lawyer John Ekpopo Martins is the chairman of the NBA Spittle section. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. In Chad, the leader of the opposition Transformers Party is denying critics who say that an agreement with the government will weaken his core ambition to become the country's next president. Success Masra says a constructive meeting with tens of thousands of party supporters since his return from exile demonstrates the trust Chadians have in his leadership. The opposition leader recently returned home following an agreement with the transitional government brokered by President Felix Tshisekedi from the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC. The accord paved the way for him to return home after his self-imposed exile. For the latest development, I reached Success Masra in the Chadian capital, in N'Djamena.
You can see from the pictures, from the number of the people, I think this is the first time in 1 year we have this number of people, you know, gathering to listen to their leader. So this shows clearly that there is a strong, credit that my supporters have on the vision that we have, the vision of equality and of justice for our country. So I feel really very honored to see that my people remain strongly committed to the struggle in which we are now.
What do you think the impact will be based on what you have seen following your meeting with your supporters? How will that help in actualizing your vision for Chad?
They trust me and they think if you manage to sign an agreement for our return to the country, then they are convinced that this is for the benefits of our people. Number two, in doing so, they are also sending a strong message to the rest of the world that they strongly believe in a new Chad where democracy should become the rule. So they understand that this agreement that broke out back here in the country is a pro-democracy agreement. So it's just for them to show me that they continue to trust our vision, our strategy, and they think also that our role is to be back in Chad so we can continue the struggle together. Because being outside of the country is somehow a weakness.
Talking about expectations and weakness, some people are suggesting that the agreement signed between you and the transitional government, brokered by President Tshisekedi of DRC, will actually be a weakness to you going forward. What say you?
If this this agreement was supposed to be a weakness, then you couldn't see this number of people. No leader were able to, you know, gather people like the one you saw yesterday in that meeting. And they agreed and they understood and they trust, you know, what we started doing. You know, we spent 6 years together. The fact that they agreed that we go for reconciliation. National reconciliation is not a weapon for weak people. It's a weapon for strong people. Because when you want to build a strong nation, then unless people can reach this kind of agreement. Because if we didn't reach that agreement, what does it mean? It means that the Chadian situation is going to be very bad. So our role is to help our people, to guide our people, so that we can bring on the table the appropriate solution. And, you know, after the meeting of yesterday, after the message that I'm getting, after even the meeting I had this morning with the president of the transition, you know, to make sure that there is follow-up on this agreement, I can tell you that I feel it's stronger than ever before.
After this meeting with your supporters and the transitional government, what's next? What is the next plan?
So the next plan is, you know, we are paying tribute to our supporters who were killed. I'm going to organize a meeting like in a place. We name the place the place of those who were killed for their fight for justice and equity in this country. So this is going to be the next thing we are going to do. But big decisions, you know, are coming, you know, on the referendum, on the process of the coming elections, etc. And as one, if not the main pro-democracy party, we are going to be part of this. So the next steps, and fortunately, the agreement included some articles about the need for me, for the facilitator, and for the leader of the transition to continue the dialogue so that we can reach a general kind of agreement, including even others who are not on the table for now.
Success Masra is the leader of the Opposition Transformers Party. He spoke with me from the Chadian capital, N'Djamena. A Liberian political analyst says the decision by incumbent President George Weah to concede defeat in the election runoff saved the country from possible conflict. Abdullah Kiatamba, the CEO of BGS Consulting, an independent media and marketing firm, says President-elect Joseph Boakai needs to unite the country and keep his campaign promises. His remarks come after the supporters of President Weah's party, the Coalition for Democratic Change, or CDC, alleged rigging of the recent election. Local media reports say some of the party members were displeased that the president conceded defeat too quickly. Abdullahi Kiatamba tells me President Weah demonstrated true leadership by conceding defeat, which he says significantly reduced tension, with many Liberians fearing there could be violence.
There's a sense of a closure. People wanted this election to be over. It was fiercely contested elections, and there were a lot of different intensity of passion and interest. And the president concession was a powerful closing, because there was fear in Monrovia on Friday that something strange could happen. Elections would not be accepted or be rejected. But over at the end, the president showed remarkable leadership, especially in the context of African incumbent, who would not even wait for the results and who concede. This is unprecedented, especially little percent.
I understand some of the president's cabinet of officers were not too pleased with his early concession, like you said. However, some people are also of the view that his early concession was due to carelessness on the part of the government officials who didn't show enough interest in protecting their vote, so to speak.
So the president said to a church service on Sunday before the cabinet meeting that if he had listened to some of the government officials, Liberia would have been in chaos because they did not want him to concede. So it was generally known in the country that certain government officials said the president should be declared the president no matter the circumstance. And so he has said in his church that if I had done what they told me to do, we would not be here. But the same thing, he also said it did not do enough to protect their own votes. Not only that, to run an effective campaign. They outspent Bwaka maybe 20-1 and still could not win an election. And so he was shocked. He did not even think the race would have been competitive between himself and Bwaka. And the fact that they got to that point, he felt that they let down the guard. They did not do as much as they could have done to prevent this loss. And so he basically said, at that point, it was important that I saved the country from the brink of a potential conflict, especially for a country that had been reeling from a 14-year conflict.
How are Liberians reacting to how he conceded defeat and promised to work for a smooth transition?
His reaction was well received. Because on Friday, a lot of people were planning emergency activities. People were concerned that something strange would have happened. So his timely concession was very important, was widely received across the country. Because there are two scenarios. If he accepts the result, the environment will be peaceful. If he does not accept the result, things will spiral out of control and we could go to a full-blown crisis that was literally irredeemable, especially given the intensity of passion that was exercised during the process. So there are more people on his side for early concession, but there are still party leaders who felt that it was too early, it was premature concession, and they felt that he should not have done it, and they felt that he had other forces that were pressurizing. So in the party itself, including one of the most influential players, the mayor, Monrovia Jefferson Koji, actually said the elections were stolen and that they had about a catalog of 24 complaints to the NEC, the Elections Commission, and those concerns were not addressed. And then the president went ahead and prematurely conceded. So, but overall, international partners, local players, civic community, media, the public in general, warmly received the president's concession. And I think it's a stroke of wisdom, especially for Liberia.
Senator Prince Johnson, reports show that he's making some very tough demands after he acted, so to speak, as a kingmaker that helped the former vice president to win the election, particularly in his constituency. How are people reacting to this?
Well, I think people knew that Prince Johnson is usually demanding. The reason why he fell apart with the current ruling party was because his demand were not met. But he has succeeded in getting a vice president, so he's going to make more demands for cabinet positions, for important agencies of the government. People know that Prince Johnson is going to make these demands. I think it will be the first test of Bwaka administration, how he handled this demand, whether it will not become a crisis. The second aspect is this is a divided mandate. You have a mandate of less than 2%, 50-49. So Bwaka, he has to create an environment where people feel that he is their president. This is his chance to prove that he is a leader that looks beyond partisan affiliation and look at the bigger picture like that. If he does that, he will send the clearest and loudest message that he seems to be a leader of all people, all political interests, of all persuasions, and all tribal groups.
Abdullah Kiatamba is the CEO of BGS Consulting, an independent media and marketing firm. He spoke with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the East African community on Friday admitted Somalia as the eighth member of the regional bloc. Somalia's admission comes just over a year after the latest entrant, the Democratic Republic of Congo, was admitted into the bloc. Mogadishu's admission into the bloc was approved by the region's leaders during the 23rd Ordinary Summit of the Heads of State held in Arusha, Tanzania. Somalia first expressed interest in joining the EAC in 2012, but was turned down due to its internal troubles with Al-Shabaab and lack of a stable legal and political environment at the time. For more on what this expansion of the regional bloc means to the stability of the region, my colleague Douglas Impuga reached political analyst David Monda.
I think it's a good opportunity, but it also has its own challenges. It's a good thing from a security perspective because we now have Somalia joining a regional economic bloc, which can also, you know, develop into a regional security bloc. So we have a regional security framework. So I think that's good in terms of thinking about migration of people, which across borders between, say, Kenya and Somalia has always been a challenge. I think Somalia joining reduces some of the human-to-human barriers that are either, you know, tariff barriers in relation to trade or non-tariff barriers in relation to certification for workers. Either Kenyans who want to work in Mogadishu or Ugandans or Tanzanians or everyone from the region is going to be easier. But I think also Somalia joining also creates its own challenges because we know the Somali government has major problems dealing with internal security. So as much as you open up borders and it's easier for goods, services, and human traffic to cross borders, it's also very easy for terror groups and for insurgents like Al-Shabaab to move through Kenya to Uganda, Somalia. And it's also easier for these terror groups to coordinate, say, between the Islamist ADF and the DRC, Uganda border, to coordinate with other Islamist groups in Somalia to create tensions within the region. So this is an interesting dynamic that has both a lot of potential opportunities, but there's also major security challenges going forward.
Somalia joins DR Congo and South Sudan, who joined the community recently. All these countries have diverse governance systems. Will the community gel with such an arrangement?
That's going to be another challenge. Not only have diverse governance systems, they have dysfunctional governance systems. So not all countries in the region are at the same economic level. There's some economies that are more advanced. If you think in Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, compared to, say, Somalia or South Sudan. So as you mentioned, they have different governance systems, some that function better, others that function worse or do not function. There's areas of South Sudan where the government just doesn't have a hand. We know there's problems in the eastern DRC where the government is not in control. There's rebel movement. So that's an important issue you raise with governance systems. But I also think the other issue with that is, in addition to governance systems, is the institutions of the community are still not strong. We do not have the horizontal levels of institutions being made strong. What I mean by that is the people-to-people institutions and contacts, the institutions that support those, the ease of traffic between borders, the ease of traffic of faculty, of students, of business people, of relatives moving from one end to the other. I think that's a major problem. When you think about governance systems, you're also thinking about trade and ease of traffic, of movement. So in terms of this new opportunity, like you mentioned, different governance systems create problems, for example, in the air transport sector. And it just leads to a challenging business and living environment in the region. Because when we have all these problems with different governance systems, we have problems then of corruption, because individuals and interests will try and circumvent governmental systems because of the bureaucracy.
There are those who long for the old East African community of Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania, where the three countries had common services, a joint airline, a joint postal service system, schools. Is that possible in this arrangement now?
I think it's possible, but I think it's also a major challenge in relation to the expansion of the community. Because philosophically and in the spirit of Pan-Africanism, it's very good for us to expand the community to include as many countries as possible. But I think rationally and economically, these state entities, a lot of them cannot sustain themselves. So when you think, for example, of the community right now, the way it's been expanded, Only two members of the community right now are up to terms with their dues to the East African community. That's Kenya and Tanzania. All the other members are either behind on their payments to either EAC or have not made their payments. So we actually have the embarrassing situation right now of South Sudan taking over the chairmanship of the EAC. And South Sudan has not paid its dues. It's not up to date with its dues, and it's not paid its dues for many years. As much as there's a speech to want to integrate as many countries as possible, I think that creates its own problems. Because as you'd mentioned earlier, there's different governance systems, but these countries also have very different histories.
David Monda is a political analyst and professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impoga from New York in Uganda. The leader of the minority in parliament says lawmakers from the opposition are united in their push to ensure the respect of human rights in the East African country. Attorney Mathias Impoga says the opposition will continue to boycott parliament until the government demonstrates a commitment to investigate and prosecute those responsible for human rights violations. His remarks come after the critics accuse the opposition of engaging in a publicity stunt to show their overseas benefactors that they are working, an accusation Impoga sharply rejects. Attorney Impoga tells me that it is the constitutional duty of the authorities to protect life and property of all Ugandans, irrespective of their political affiliations.
We raise these pertinent issues over gross abuse of human rights, including killings on several lake shores in Uganda that are not explained and nobody is accountable. The government at one time came and held a meeting with my small team, with the Speaker of Parliament, and they made a commitment that in 30 days, they'll be able to come and account for all these issues. The 30 days expired last week. As we speak, they haven't made any further commitment as to what they will do. And in our case, we are not going to return to the chamber until accountability is made and until there's commitment to the stopping of abuse of human rights, impunity, and bring to book all those that were involved in this gross abuse of human rights in the country.
How long are you willing to hold out, to boycott parliament? Because critics of yours are saying this is just a mere publicity stunt. They are questioning even the timing of this boycott as politically self-serving.
Whether self-serving or not, in fact, the boycott we are undergoing is the highest level of representation. I think in boycotting parliament, we are actually representing the views of our people. If you came and sampled the views of the people in Kampala and everywhere, the people are with us in this boycott, and therefore we're not frolicking on our own. That even gives us more impetus to hold on. I can tell you we are ready for the long haul until sensibility returns to the powers that be and ready themselves to make full accountability. We shall go the long haul.
Critics are saying that this move appears to be an action taken to please your paymasters abroad, to show to them that you are fighting for a cause, because for all these years that you said people have been abducted, their rights abused and all that, you never took an action until when it's the end of the year, when people are expecting an accountability of funds provided to your cause. That is when you are making this move. Your response to that?
On another day, I would have asked you to name our paymasters. As far as I'm aware, the people who really keep us in parliament are the Ugandan taxpayers. I am not aware of any foreign paymasters. Secondly, the simple question. Are they missing Ugandans? If indeed we are politicking, why wouldn't the regime, because we have profiled all these missing persons from their families, their relatives, their children, their wives, their parents, so why should they produce them and actually render the whole boycott flat? Just produce the people. Why wouldn't you account for the missing people? Why don't you bring to book those who shot and killed over 100 people on the streets of Kampala? Why don't you alert them to court and render our boycott inconsequential? Account for the 18 missing persons and render us with no business. Otherwise, as long as you are not accounted, I can say we are in business, and the business is the business of the people, and we owe nobody an apology.
What do you say to the critics who are saying that due to the overwhelming majority of the NRM, the ruling party in parliament, the opposition boycott is inconsequential and that the business of the House will continue irrespective of the boycott?
Well, that they will say on the face, but the regime is definitely hurting. Without the opposition, the House looks like a funeral. Their numbers can't count in the circumstances. But most importantly, if our numbers don't count, does it then follow that the majority can get away with murder, that they can enforce disappearance and then get away with it because they're a minority? Our business is the business of enforcing the rights of the minority in whichever space we are thriving in. The derogatory reference to our boycott cannot stop us from continuing and pushing for the rights of our people. Just think about the fact that this goes on unabated, and the next round of election brings the same issue of disappearances, of killings. What kind of democracy are we building? We are actually immunizing the country from going down the drain where we are watching, with the leaders in parliament, and therefore it doesn't matter when and how, but the government must account. The long and short of it is that they must account for their actions and bring to book those who participated in abusing the rights of the people.
Attorney Mathias Mpuuga is the leader of the minority in parliament. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The leader of the opposition party Zambia Must Prosper is calling on the police to arrest ruling party supporters accused of harassing and intimidating opponents of the administration. Attorney Kelvin Bwala Few says their behavior must stop. He warned the police and other state institutions that there are constitutional provisions for freedom of speech and assembly. His remarks follow videos circulating on social media platforms showing ruling party supporters harassing Harry Kalaba, leader of the Citizens First Party, and his supporters during campaigns for the by-election in Insama District in Northern Province. Kelvin Bwalia also tells me opposition parties are in talks to form an alliance ahead of the next general election.
There have been some shootings and killings going on in Zambia, which is rather unprecedented. And the many arrests that have followed the opposition leaders and the harassment and intimidation, we are seeing a pattern developing, which we are now saying should stop. Because there is a by-election in a ward called Insama, somewhere in Muchinga province. This is for a councillor, and everybody must be free on the ground to go and campaign. So what we saw was the Minister of Sport, certain Elvis Nkandu, honorable, galvanizing UPND cadres to block Harry Kalaba and his entourage, basically trying to make their campaigns difficult. I mean, we can't allow this. What we've been having of late is we've been having a series of meetings as opposition leaders. And what we've decided is we want to begin to work towards an alliance.
But some people are suggesting that the opposition keeps breaking the law willfully and willingly and then turn around and accuse the police of being influenced by the ruling party. Isn't this disingenuous if you are asking your supporters to break the law willfully?
No, Peter, no. That nothing could be further from the truth. The police are the ones with the authority. The ruling party is the one with the authority. And all they are doing now is, because the telltale signs are beginning to show that they're losing grip on the ground, and the opposition leaders are beginning to talk to each other with a view of forming an alliance, obviously, they can hear the footsteps that there is something brewing and they might lose power. So they are going to spin these stories in their favor.
Some analysts that I spoke with are suggesting that the plan by opposition groups to unite might be difficult because there are too many opposition parties. Everybody wants to become a president. And your egos are too big that it will be very difficult for you to put your egos or your ambitions aside to support one candidate to challenge the incumbent president. How do you respond to that?
Peter, if you know any history about this country,
In 1990, running up to 1991, when the MMD came together, do you know how many egos we had? We had very, very strong, big egos. We had the names and likes of Arthur Wiener, Humphrey Mlemba. We had rich people like Emmanuel Kasonde. We had Shamwana and the rest. These were eminent persons in their own right. But you see, when it came to choosing a leader and they put the nation first, everybody put their egos aside. There is no way that when we engage in the deep discussions, we are not going to put our differences aside. No one should tell you that. We are discussing and trying to iron out all those differences. But we are coming together. And we are coming together for the benefit and betterment of this country. We cannot proceed on this trajectory. We can't. Because the country right now is in doldrums. So we are talking to each other because we understand that the nation must be put first. So the fact that there are so many political leaders or so many opposition political parties must not worry anybody. The goodness about this time is we've actually got more time than the MMD had. So we will be talking and we shall iron out all these differences. And soon enough, a leader will be found and everybody will rally behind that leader.
Attorney Kelvin Bwali Afube is the leader of the opposition party Zambia Must Prosper. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
You got my patient as come, so that ego tell you a story. Your picking up ever is small, my call can be on respect. Me and you no go able pay them for the one with them on me. So do your mind the words
and know what you for say.
Do your mind the action
and know what you for do.
Excuse me, madam. Waiting on your name.
Name them Sunita.
Okay, I want for talk with you.
No problem.
I've been seeing you they go up and down. Waiting on your mission. You go school.
Oh yes, but really I no go far.
Waiting make you no continue. They call you young too.
No long story, uncle. Really I for talk.
I really want for no. Because myself can't get picky.
Now long story, uncle. It's a story, oh.
I like it long like monkey bridge. Tell me you never know.
Me mama died the same day where you born me. Me love you, papa. Now ain't no more bring the take care. They give me all kind of college because I've been there trying to school. You know we get much, but I know I'm to sleep hungry. Struggle for me, cause he say I land boo. Man can predict well, well.
But go online, get the final say.
Now we think making not continue. Just let it so.
It's so sorry, oh good.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga and engineer Al Santos, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, only a medicine man gets rich by sleeping. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
When them no say me daddy let me so much, now that's make the heart round.
Dengue and the gun now, they say well you kill you begin. Where daddy turn watch me, what a run I'm guy. I no be a boss cry, for me loving papa. The chukana I ate the uncle command, say kill you begin. Where I see blood they splash. So God I nearly faint.
I tell daddy say kill me. If nana no more go save your life.
Daddy look me in the eye. Shaky head and boss cry. Daddy hold the gun in hand. But
to God in a fire. Daddy says, Sumitan, I'm not get mine for kill you. Make her die with